Audio Bookshelf presents A Separate Piece by John Knowles. Read by Scott Snively. Chapter 1. I went back to the Devon School not long ago and found it looking oddly newer than when I was a student there 15 years before. It seemed more sedate than I remembered it, more perpendicular and straight-laced, with narrower windows and shinier woodwork, as though a coat of varnish had been put over everything for better preservation. But of course, 15 years before, there'd been a war going on. Perhaps the school wasn't as well kept up in those days. Perhaps varnish, along with everything else, had gone to war. I didn't entirely like this glossy new surface, because it made the school look like a museum, and that's exactly what it was to me, and what I did not want it to be. In the deep, tacit way in which feeling becomes stronger than thought, I had always felt that the Devon School came into existence the day I entered it, was vibrantly real while I was a student there, and then blinked out like a candle the day I left. Now, here it was after all, preserved by some considerate hand with varnish and wax. Preserved along with it, like stale air in an unopened room, was the well-known fear which had surrounded and filled those days. So much of it that I hadn't even known it was there. Because unfamiliar with the absence of fear and what that was like, I had not been able to identify its presence. Looking back now across 15 years, I could see with great clarity the fear I lived in, which must mean that in the interval I had succeeded in a very important undertaking. I must have made my escape from it. I felt fear's echo, and along with that I felt the unhinged, uncontrollable joy which had been its accompaniment and opposite face. Joy which had broken out sometimes in those days like northern lights across black sky. There were a couple of places now which I wanted to see. Both were fearful sights, and that is why I wanted to see them. So after lunch at the Devon Inn, I walked back toward the school. It was a raw, nondescript time of year, toward the end of November, the kind of wet, self-pitying November day when every speck of dirt stands out clearly. Devon, luckily, had very little of such weather. The icy clamp of winter or the radiant New Hampshire summers were more characteristic of it. But this day, it blew wet, moody gusts all around me. I walked along Gilman Street, the best street in town. The houses were as handsome and unusual as I remembered. Clever modernizations of old colonial manses. Extensions in Victorian wood. Capacious Greek Revival temples lined the street, as impressive and just as forbidding as ever. I had rarely seen anyone go into one of them, or anyone playing on the lawn, or even an open window. Today, with their failing ivy and stripped, moaning trees, the houses looked both more elegant and more lifeless than ever. Like all old good schools, Devon did not stand isolated behind walls and gates, but emerged naturally from the town which had produced it. So there was no sudden moment of encounter as I approached it. The houses along Gilman Street began to look more defensive, which meant that I was nearer the school, and then more exhausted, which meant I was in it. It was early afternoon, and the grounds and buildings were deserted, since everyone was at sports. There was nothing to distract me as I made my way across a wide yard called the Far Commons, and up to a building as red brick and balanced as the other major buildings, but with a large cupola and a bell and a clock and Latin over the doorway, the first academy building. In through the swinging doors I reached a marble foyer and stopped at the foot of a long, white marble flight of stairs. Although they were old stairs, the worn moons in the middle of each step were not very deep. The marble must be unusually hard. That seemed very likely, only too likely. Although with all my thought about these stairs, this exceptional hardness had not occurred to me. It was surprising that I had overlooked that crucial fact. There was nothing else to notice. They, of course, were the same stairs I had walked up and down at least once every day of my Devon life. They were the same as ever. And I? Well, naturally, I felt older. I began at that point the emotional examination to note how far my convalescence had gone. I was taller, bigger, generally, in relation to these stairs. I had more money and success and security than in the days when specters seemed to go up and down them with me. I turned away and went back outside. The far common was still empty, and I walked alone down the wide gravel paths among those most Republican, bankerish of trees, New England elms, toward the far side of the school. Devon is sometimes considered the most beautiful school in New England, and even on this dismal afternoon its power was asserted. It is the beauty of small areas of order. A large yard, a group of trees, three similar dormitories, a circle of old houses living together in contentious harmony. You felt that an argument might begin at any time. In fact, it had, out of the dean's residence, a pure and authentic colonial house. There now sprouted an L with a big, bare picture window. Someday, the dean would probably live entirely encased in a house of glass and be happy as a sandpiper. Everything at Devon slowly changed and slowly harmonized with what had gone before. So it was logical to hope that since the buildings and the deans and the curriculum could achieve this, I could achieve, perhaps unknowingly already had achieved, this growth and harmony myself. I would know more about that when I had seen the second place I had come to see. So I roamed on past the balanced red brick dormitories with webs of leafless ivy clinging to them, through a ramshackle salient of the town which invaded the school for 100 yards, past the solid gymnasium, full of students at this hour, but silent as a monument on the outside, past the field house, called the Cage. I remember now what a mystery references to the cage had been during my first weeks at Devon. I had thought it must be a place of severe punishment. And I reached the huge, open sweep of ground known as the playing fields. Devon was both scholarly and very athletic, so the playing fields were vast and, except at such a time of year, constantly in use. Now they reached soggily and emptily away from me. Forlorn tennis courts on the left, enormous football and soccer and lacrosse fields in the center, woods on the right, and at the far end a small river, detectable from this distance by the few bare trees along its banks. It was such a gray and misty day that I could not see the other side of the river, where there was a small stadium. I started the long trudge across the fields, and had gone some distance before I paid any attention to the soft and muddy ground, which was dooming my city shoes. I didn't stop. Near the center of the fields there were thin lakes of muddy water, which I had to make my way around, my unrecognizable shoes making obscene noises as I lifted them out of the mire. With nothing to block it, the wind flung wet gusts at me. At any other time, I would have felt like a fool slogging through mud and rain, only to look at a tree. A little fog hung over the river, so that as I neared it, I felt myself becoming isolated from everything except the river and a few trees beside it. The wind was blowing more steadily here, and I was beginning to feel cold. I never wore a hat and had forgotten my gloves. There were several trees bleakly reaching into the fog. Any one of them might have been the one I was looking for. Unbelievable that there were other trees which looked like it here. It had loomed in my memory as a huge, lone spike dominating the river bank, forbidding as an artillery piece, high as the beanstalk. Yet here was a scattered grove of trees, none of them of any particular grandeur. Moving through the soaked, coarse grass, I began to examine each one closely, and finally identified the tree I was looking for by means of certain small scars rising along its trunk, and by a limb extending over the river, and another, thinner limb growing near it. This was the tree. And it seemed to me standing there to resemble those men, the giants of your childhood, whom you encounter years later, and find that they are not merely smaller in relation to your growth, but that they are absolutely smaller, shrunken by age. In this double demotion, the old giants have become pygmies while you were looking the other way. The tree was not only stripped by the cold season, it seemed weary from age, enfeebled, dry. I was thankful, very thankful that I had seen it. So, the more things remain the same, the more they changed after all. Plus c'est la même chose, plus c'est change. Nothing endures. Not a tree, not love, not even a death by violence. Changed, I headed back through the mud. I was drenched. Anybody could see it was time to come in out of the rain. The tree was tremendous, an irate, steely, black steeple beside the river. I was damned if I'd climb it. The hell with it! No one but Phineas could think up such a crazy idea. He, of course, saw nothing the slightest bit intimidating about it. He wouldn't, or wouldn't admit it if he did. Not Phineas. "What I like best about this tree," he said in that voice of his, the equivalent in sound of a hypnotist's eyes, "what I like is that it's such a cinch." He opened his green eyes wider and gave us his maniac look, and only the smirk on his wide mouth with its droll, slightly protruding upper lip reassured us that he wasn't completely goofy. "Is that what you like best?" I said sarcastically. I said a lot of things sarcastically that summer. It was my sarcastic summer, 1942. "Eh?" he said. This weird New England affirmative, maybe it's spelled A-I-E-H-U-H, always made me laugh, as Finney knew, so I had to laugh, which made me feel less sarcastic and less scared. There were three others with us. Phineas in those days almost always moved in groups the size of a hockey team, and they stood with me, looking with masked apprehension from him to the tree. Its soaring black trunk was set with rough wooden pegs leading up to a substantial limb which extended farther toward the water. Standing on this limb, you could, by a prodigious effort, jump far enough out into the river for safety. So we had heard. At least the 17-year-old bunch could do it. But they had a crucial year's advantage over us. No upper middler, which was the name for our class in the Devon School, had ever tried. Naturally, Finney was going to be the first to try. And just as naturally, he was going to inveigle others, us, into trying it with him. We were not even upper middler, exactly, for this was the summer session, just established to keep up with the pace of the war. We were in shaky transit that summer from the groveling status of lower middlers to the near respectability of upper middlers. The class above, seniors, draft bait, practically soldiers, rushed ahead of us toward the war. They were caught up in accelerated courses and first aid programs and a physical hardening regimen, which included jumping from this tree. We were still calmly, numbly, reading Virgil and playing tag in the river farther downstream, until Finney thought of the tree. We stood looking up at it, four looks of consternation, one of excitement. "Do you want to go first?" Finney asked us rhetorically. We just looked quietly back at him. And so he began taking off his clothes, stripping down to his underpants. For such an extraordinary athlete, even as a lower middler, Phineas had been the best athlete in the school. He was not spectacularly built. He was my height, 5 feet 8.5 inches. I had been claiming 5 feet 9 inches before he became my roommate, but he had said in public, with that simple, shocking self-acceptance of his, "No, you're the same height I am. 5'8.5". We're on the short side." He weighed 150 pounds, a galling 10 pounds more than I did, which flowed from his legs to torso, round shoulders to arms, and full strong neck in an uninterrupted, unemphatic unity of strength. He began scrambling up the wooden pegs nailed to the side of the tree, his back muscles working like a panther's. The pegs didn't seem strong enough to hold his weight. At last, he stepped onto the branch, which reached a little farther toward the water. "Is this the one they jump from?" None of us knew. "If I do it, you're all going to do it, aren't you?" We didn't say anything very clearly. "Well," he cried out, "here's my contribution to the war effort." And he sprang out, fell through the tops of some lower branches, and smashed into the water. "Great!" he said, bobbing instantly to the surface again, his wet hair plastered in droll bangs on his forehead.
That's the most fun I've had this week. Who's next?
I was. This tree flooded me with a sensation of alarm all the way to my tingling fingers. My head began to feel unnaturally light, and the vague rustling sounds from the nearby woods came to me as though muffled and filtered. I must have been entering a mild state of shock. Insulated by this, I took off my clothes and started to climb the pegs. I don't remember saying anything. The branch he had jumped from was slenderer than it looked from the ground, and much higher. It was impossible to walk out on it far enough to be well over the river. I would have to spring far out or risk falling into the shallow water next to the bank.
"Come on!" drawled Finney from below. "Stop standing there showing off!"
I recognized with automatic tenseness that the view was very impressive from here.
"When they torpedo the troop ship," he shouted, "you can't stand around admiring the view! Jump!"
What was I doing up here anyway? Why did I let Finney talk me into stupid things like this? Was he getting some kind of hold over me?
"Jump!"
With the sensation that I was throwing my life away, I jumped into space. Some tips of branches snapped past me, and then I crashed into the water. My legs hit the soft mud of the bottom, and immediately I was on the surface, being congratulated. I felt fine.
"I think that was better than Finney's," said Elwyn, better known as Leper Lepellier,
who was bidding for an ally in the dispute he foresaw.
"All right, pal," Finney spoke in his cordial, penetrating voice, that reverberant instrument in his chest. "Don't start awarding prizes until you've passed the course. The tree is waiting."
Leper closed his mouth as though forever. He didn't argue or refuse. He didn't back away. He became inanimate. But the other two, Chet Douglas and Bobby Zane, were vocal enough, complaining shrilly about school regulations, the danger of stomach cramps, physical disabilities they had never mentioned before.
"It's you, pal," Finney said to me at last. "Just you and me."
He and I started back across the fields, preceding the others like two seniors. We were the best of friends at that moment.
"You were very good," said Finney good-humoredly, "once I shamed you into it."
"You didn't shame anybody into anything."
"Oh, yes, I did. I'm good for you that way. You have a tendency to back away from things otherwise."
"I never backed away from anything in my life," I cried, my indignation at this charge naturally stronger because it was so true.
"You're goofy."
Phineas just walked serenely on, or rather flowed on, rolling forward in his white sneakers with such unthinking unity of movement that walk didn't describe it. I went along beside him, across the enormous playing fields, toward the gym. Underfoot, the healthy green turf was brushed with dew, and ahead of us, we could see a faint green haze hanging above the grass, shot through with twilight sun. Phineas stopped talking for once, so that now I could hear cricket noises and bird cries of dusk. A gymnasium truck gunning along an empty athletic road a quarter mile away. A burst of faint, isolated laughter carried to us from the back door of the gym. And then, overall, cool and matriarchal, the 6 o'clock bell from the academy building cupola. The calmest, most carrying bell toll in the world. Civilized. Calm, invincible, and final. The toll sailed over the expansive tops of all the elms, the great slanting roofs and formidable chimneys of the dormitories, the narrow and brittle old housetops across the open New Hampshire sky to us coming back from the river. "We'd better hurry, or we'll be late for dinner," I said, breaking into what Finney called my West Point stride. Phineas didn't really dislike West Point in particular, or authority in general, but just considered authority the necessary evil against which happiness was achieved by reaction. The backboard, which returned all the insults he threw at it.
My West Point stride was intolerable. His right foot flashed into the middle of my fast walk, and I went pitching forward into the grass. "Get those 150 pounds off of me!" I shouted, because he was sitting on my back. Finney got up, patted my head genially, and moved on across the field, not deigning to glance around for my counterattack, but relying on his extrasensory ears, his ability to feel in the air someone coming on him from behind. As I sprang at him, he sidestepped easily, but I just managed to kick him as I shot past. He caught my leg, and there was a brief wrestling match on the turf, which he won.
"Better hurry," he said, "or they'll put you in the guardhouse."
We were walking again, faster. Bobby and Leper and Chet were urging us from ahead, for God's sake, to hurry up. And then Finney trapped me again in his strongest trap. That is, I suddenly became his collaborator. As we walked rapidly along, I abruptly resented the bell and my West Point stride and hurrying and conforming. Finney was right, and there was only one way to show him this. I threw my hip against his, catching him by surprise, and he was instantly down, definitely pleased. This was why he liked me so much. When I jumped on top of him, my knees on his chest, he couldn't ask for anything better. We struggled in some equality for a while, and then, when we were sure we were too late for dinner, we broke off. He and I passed the gym and came on toward the first group of dormitories, which were dark and silent. There were only 200 of us at Devon in the summer, not enough to fill most of the school. We passed the sprawling headmaster's house, empty. He was doing something for the government in Washington. Past the chapel, empty again, used only for a short time in the mornings. Past the first academy building, where there were some dim lights shining from a few of its many windows. Masters at work in their classrooms there. Down a short slope into the broad and well-clipped common, on which light fell from the big surrounding Georgian buildings. A dozen boys were loafing there on the grass after dinner, and a kitchen rattle from the wing of one of the buildings accompanied their talk. The sky was darkening steadily, which brought up the lights in the dormitories and the old houses. A loud phonograph a long way off played, "Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree," rejected that, and played, "They're Either Too Young or Too Old," grew more ambitious with the Warsaw Concerto, mellower with a Nutcracker Suite, and then stopped. Finney and I went to our room. Under the yellow study lights, we read our Hardy assignments. I was halfway through Tests of the D'Urbervilles. He carried on his baffled struggle with Far From the Madding Crowd, amused that there should be people named Gabriel Oak and Bathsheba Everdeen. Our illegal radio, turned too low to be intelligible, was broadcasting the news. Outside, there was a rustling early summer movement of the wind. The seniors, allowed out later than we were, came fairly quietly back as the bell sounded 10 stately times. Boys ambled past our door toward the bathroom, and there was a period of steadily pouring shower water. Then lights began to snap out all over the school. We undressed, and I put on some pajamas, but Phineas, who had heard they were unmilitary, didn't. There was the silence in which it was understood we were saying some prayers, and then that summer school day came to an end. Chapter 2. Our absence from dinner had been noticed. The following morning, the clean, washed shine of summer mornings in the North Country, Mr. Prudham stopped at our door. He was broad-shouldered, grave, and wore a gray business suit. He did not have the careless, almost British look of most of the Devon masters, because he was a substitute for the summer. He enforced such rules as he knew. Missing dinner was one of them. "We had been swimming in the river," Finney explained. "Then there had been a wrestling match. Then there was that sunset that anybody would want to watch. Then there had been several friends we had to see on business. he rambled on, his voice soaring and plunging in its vibrant soundbox, his eyes now and then widening to fire a flash of green across the room. Standing in the shadows, with a bright window behind him, he blazed with sunburned health. As Mr. Prudhomme looked at him and listened to the scatterbrained eloquence of his explanation, he could be seen rapidly losing his grip on sternness. "If you hadn't already missed 9 meals in the last 2 weeks," he broke in. But Finney pressed his advantage, not because he wanted to be forgiven for missing a meal. That didn't interest him at all. He might have rather enjoyed the punishment, if it had been done in some novel and unknown way. He pressed his advantage because he saw that Mr. Prudhomme was pleased, won over in spite of himself. The master was slipping from his official position momentarily, and it was just possible, if Phineas pressed hard enough, that there might be a flow of simple, unregulated friendliness between them, and such flows were one of Phineas's reasons for living.
"The real reason, sir, was that we just had to jump out of that tree. You know that tree."
I knew. Mr. Prudhomme must have known. Finney knew, if he stopped to think, that jumping out of the tree was even more forbidden than missing a meal.
"We had to do it naturally," he went on, "because we're all getting ready for the war. What if they lower the draft age to 17? Jean and I are both going to be 17 at the end of the summer, which is a very convenient time since it's the start of the academic year, and there's never any doubt about which class you should be in. Leper Lapellier is already 17, and if I'm not mistaken, he will be draftable before the end of this next academic year. And so, conceivably, he ought to have been in the class ahead. He ought to have been a senior by now, if you see what I mean. So that he would have been graduated and been all set to be drafted. But we're all right, Jean and I are perfectly all right. There isn't any question that we are conforming in every possible way to everything that's happening and everything that's going to happen. That's all a question of birthdays, unless you want to be more specific and look at it from the sexual point of view, which I have never cared to do myself, since it's a question of my mother and my father, and I have never felt I wanted to think about their sexual lives too much." Everything he said was true and sincere. Finney always said what he happened to be thinking, and if this stunned people, then he was surprised. Mr. Prudhomme released his breath with a sort of amazed laugh, stared at Finney for a while, and that was all there was to it. This was the way the masters tended to treat us that summer. They seemed to be modifying their usual attitude of floating, chronic disapproval. During the winter, most of them regarded anything unexpected in a student with suspicion, seeming to feel that anything we said or did was potentially illegal. Now, on these clear June days in New Hampshire, they appeared to uncoil. They seemed to believe that we were with them about half the time and only spent the other half trying to make fools of them. A streak of tolerance was detectable. Finney decided that they were beginning to show commendable signs of maturity. It was partly his doing. The Devon faculty had never before experienced a student who combined a calm ignorance of the rules with a winning urge to be good, who seemed to love the school truly and deeply, and never more than when he was breaking the regulations. A model boy, who was most comfortable in the truant's corner. The faculty threw up its hands over Phineas, and so loosened its grip on all of us. There was another reason. I think we reminded them of what peace was like, we boys of 16. We were registered with no draft board. We had taken no physical examinations. No one had ever tested us for hernia or color blindness. Tricked knees and punctured eardrums were minor complaints and not yet disabilities which would separate a few from the fate of the rest. We were careless and wild, and I suppose we could be thought of as a sign of the life the war was being fought to preserve. Anyway, they were more indulgent toward us than at any other time. They snapped at the heels of the seniors, driving and molding and arming them for the war. They noticed our games tolerantly.
We reminded them of what peace was like, of lives which were not bound up with destruction. Phineas was the essence of this careless peace. Not that he was unconcerned about the war. After Mr. Prudhomme left, he began to dress. That is, he began to reach for whatever clothes were nearest, some of them mine. Then he stopped to consider and went over to the dresser. Out of one of the drawers, he lifted a finely woven broadcloth shirt, carefully cut and very pink. "What's that thing?"
"This is a tablecloth,"
he said out of the side of his mouth. "No, cut it out. What is it?"
"This," he then answered with some pride, "is going to be my emblem. Ma sent it up last week. Did you ever see stuff like this? And a color like this? It doesn't even button all the way down. You have to pull it over your head like this."
"Over your head? Pink? It makes you look like a fairy."
"Does it?"
He used this preoccupied tone when he was thinking of something more interesting than what you had said. But his mind always recorded what was said and played it back to him when there was time. So as he buttoned the high collar in front of the mirror, he said mildly,
"I wonder what would happen if I looked like a fairy to everyone."
"You're nuts."
"Well, in case suitors begin clamoring at the door, you can tell them I'm wearing this as an emblem."
He turned around to let me admire it.
"I was reading in the paper that we bombed Central Europe for the first time the other day."
Only someone who knew Phineas as well as I did could realize that he was not changing the subject. I waited quietly for him to make whatever fantastic connection there might be between this and his shirt.
"Well, we've got to do something to celebrate. We haven't got a flag. We can't float Old Glory proudly out the window. So I'm going to wear this as an emblem."
He did wear it. No one else in school could have done so without some risk of having it torn from his back. When the sternest of the summer session masters, old Mr. Patch Withers, came up to him after history class and asked about it, I watched his drawn but pink face become pinker with amusement as Finney politely explained the meaning of the shirt. It was hypnotism. I was beginning to see that Phineas could get away with anything. I couldn't help envying him that a little, which was perfectly normal. There was no harm in envying even your best friend a little. In the afternoon, Mr. Patch Withers, who was substitute headmaster for the summer, offered the traditional term tea to the upper middle class. It was held in the deserted headmaster's house, and Mr. Patch Withers' wife trembled at every cup tinkle. We were in a kind of sun porch and conservatory combined, spacious and damp and without many plants. Those there were had large non-flowering stalks with big barbaric leaves. The chocolate brown wicker furniture shot out menacing twigs, and 36 of us stood tensely teetering our cups amid the wicker and leaves, trying hard not to sound as inane in our conversation with the 4 present masters and their wives as they sounded to us. Phineas had soaked and brushed his hair for the occasion. This gave his head a sleek look, which was contradicted by the surprised, honest expression he wore on his face. His ears, I had never noticed before, were fairly small and set close to his head, and combined with his plastered hair, they now gave his bold nose and cheekbones the sharp look of a prow. He alone talked easily. He discussed the bombing of Central Europe. No one else happened to have seen the story, and since Phineas could not recall exactly what target in which country had been hit, or whether it was the American, British, or even Russian Air Force which had hit it, or what day he had read it in which newspaper, the discussion was one-sided. That didn't matter. It was the event which counted. But after a while, Finney felt he should carry the discussion to others.
"I think we ought to bomb the daylights out of them, as long as we don't hit any women or children or old people, don't you?"
he was saying to Mrs. Patch Withers, perched nervously behind her urn.
"Or hospitals," he went on, "and naturally no schools or churches." "We must also be careful about works of art," she put in, "if they are of permanent value."
A lot of nonsense, Mr. Patch Withers grumbled with his flushed face. How can you expect our boys to be as precise as that, thousands of feet up with bombs weighing tons? Look at what the Germans did to Amsterdam. Look at what they did to Coventry.
The Germans aren't the Central Europeans, dear, his wife said very gently.
He didn't like being brought up short, but he seemed to be just able to bear it from his wife. After a temperamental pause, he said gruffly,
There isn't any permanent art in Central Europe anyway.
Finney was enjoying this. He unbuttoned his seersucker jacket, as though he needed greater body freedom for the discussion. Mrs. Patch Withers' glance then happened to fall on his belt. In a tentative voice, she said,
Isn't that the... our...
Her husband looked. I panicked. In his haste that morning, Finney had, not unexpectedly, used a tie for a belt. But this morning, the first tie at hand had been the Devon school tie. This time, he wasn't going to get away with it. I could feel myself becoming unexpectedly excited at that. Mr. Patchwither's face was reaching a brilliant shade, and his wife's head fell as though before the guillotine. Even Finney seemed to color a little, unless it was the reflection from his pink shirt. But his expression was composed, and he said in his resonant voice, I wore this, you see, because it goes with the shirt. It all ties together. I didn't mean that to be a pun. I don't think they're very funny, especially in polite company. Do you? It all ties in together with what we've been talking about, this bombing in Central Europe. Because when you come right down to it, the school is involved in everything that happens in the war. It's all the same war and the same world, and I think Devon ought to be included. I don't know whether you think the way I do on that. Mr. Patchwither's face had been shifting expressions and changing colors continuously, and now it settled into fixed surprise.
I've never heard anything so illogical as that in my life.
He didn't sound very indignant, though.
That's probably the strangest tribute this school has had in 160 years.
He seemed pleased, or amused in some unknown corner of his mind. Phineas was going to get away with even this. His eyes gave their wider, magical gleam, and his voice continued on a more compelling level. Although I have to admit, I didn't think of that when I put it on this morning. He smiled pleasantly after supplying this interesting additional information. Mr. Patch Withers settled into a hearty silence at this, and so Finney added,
I'm glad I put on something for a belt. I certainly would hate the embarrassment of having my pants fall down at the headmaster's tea. Of course he isn't here, but it would be just as embarrassing in front of you and Mrs. Patch Withers.
And he smiled politely down at her. Mr. Patch Withers' laughter surprised us all, including himself. His face, whose shades we had often labeled, now achieved a new one. Phineas was very happy. Sour and stern Mr. Patch Withers had been given a good laugh for once, and he had done it. He broke into the charmed, thoughtless grin of a man fulfilled. He had gotten away with everything. I felt a sudden stab of disappointment. That was because I just wanted to see some more excitement. That must have been it. We left the party, both of us feeling fine. I laughed along with Finney, my best friend, and also unique, able to get away with anything at all. And not because he was a conniver, either. I was sure of that. He got away with everything because of the extraordinary kind of person he was. It was quite a compliment to me, as a matter of fact, to have such a person choose me for his best friend. Finney never left anything alone. Not when it was well enough. Not when it was perfect.
Let's go jump in the river, he said under his breath as we went out of the sun porch.
He forced compliance by leaning against me as we walked along, changing my direction. Like a police car squeezing me to the side of the road, he directed me, unwillingly, toward the gym and the river.
We need to clear our heads of that party, he said. All that talk.
Yes, it sure was boring.
Who did most of the talking anyway?
Finney concentrated.
Mr. Patch Withers was pretty gassy, and his wife, and...
Yeah, and? Turning a look of mock shock on me.
You don't mean to infer that I talk too much?
Returning with interest his gaping shock.
You? Talk too much? How can you accuse me of accusing you of that?
As I said, this was my sarcastic summer. It was only long after that I recognized sarcasm as the protest of people who are weak. We walked along through the shining afternoon to the river.
I don't really believe we bombed Central Europe, do you?
Said Finney thoughtfully. The dormitories we passed were massive and almost anonymous behind their thick layers of ivy. Big, old-looking leaves you would have thought stayed there winter and summer, permanent hanging gardens in New Hampshire. Between the buildings, elms curved so high that you ceased to remember their height until you looked above the familiar trunks and the lowest umbrella of leaves and took in the lofty complex they held high above. Branches and branches of branches, a world of branches with an infinity of leaves. They, too, seemed permanent and never-changing, an untouched, unreachable world high in space, like the ornamental towers and spires of a great church, too high to be enjoyed, too high for anything, great and remote and never useful.
No, I don't think I believe it either, I answered.
Far ahead of us, four boys, looking like white flags on the endless green playing fields, crossed toward the tennis courts. To the right of them, the gym meditated behind its gray walls, the high, wide, oval-topped windows shining back at the sun. Beyond the gym and the fields began the woods, our, the Devon School's woods, which in my imagination were the beginning of the great northern forests. I thought that, from the Devon woods, trees reached in an unbroken, widening corridor so far to the north that no one had ever seen the other end, somewhere up in the far, unorganized tips of Canada. We seemed to be playing on the tame fringe of the last and greatest wilderness. I never found out whether this is so, and perhaps it is. Bombs in Central Europe were completely unreal to us here. Not because we couldn't imagine it. 1,000 newspaper photographs and newsreels had given us a pretty accurate idea of such a sight. But because our place here was too fair for us to accept something like that. We spent that summer in complete selfishness, I'm happy to say. The people in the world who could be selfish in the summer of 1942 were a small band, and I'm glad we took advantage of it.
The first person to say anything unpleasant will get a swift kick in the ass, said Finney reflectively as we came to the river.
All right.
Are you still afraid to jump out of the tree?
There's something unpleasant about that question, isn't there?
That question? No, of course not. It depends on how you answer it.
Afraid to jump out of that tree?
I expect it will be a very pleasant jump.
After we had swum around in the water for a while, Finney said,
Will you do me the pleasure of jumping out of the tree first?
My pleasure. Rigid, I began climbing the rungs, slightly reassured by having Finney right behind me.
We'll jump together to cement our partnership, he said. We'll form a suicide society, and the membership requirement is one jump out of this tree.
A suicide society? I said stiffly. The Suicide Society of the Summer Session.
Good! The Super Suicide Society of the Summer Session. How's that?
That's fine. That's okay. We were standing on a limb, I a little farther out than Finney. I turned to say something else, some stalling remark, something to delay even a few seconds more, and then I realized that in turning, I began to lose my balance. There was a moment of total impersonal panic, and then Finney's hand shot out and grabbed my arm. And with my balance restored, the panic immediately disappeared. I turned back toward the river,
moved a few more steps along the limb, sprang far out, and fell into the deep water. Finney also made a good jump, and the Super Suicide Society of the summer session was officially established. It was only after dinner, when I was on my way alone to the library, that the full danger I had brushed on the limb shook me again. If Finney hadn't come up right behind me, if he hadn't been there, I could have fallen on the bank and broken my back. If I had fallen awkwardly enough, I could have been killed. Finney had practically saved my life.
Chapter 3. Yes, he had practically saved my life. He had also practically lost it for me. I wouldn't have been on that damn limb except for him. I wouldn't have turned around and so lost my balance if he hadn't been there. I didn't need to feel any tremendous rush of gratitude toward Phineas. The Super Suicide Society of the summer session was a success from the start. That night, Finney began to talk abstractedly about it, as though it were a venerable, entrenched institution of the Devon School. The half-dozen friends who were there in our room listening began to bring up small questions on details without ever quite saying that they had never heard of such a club. Schools are supposed to be catacombed with secret societies and underground brotherhoods, and as far as they knew, here was one which had just come to the surface. They signed up as trainees on the spot. We began to meet every night to initiate them. The charter members, he and I, had to open every meeting by jumping ourselves. This was the first of many rules which Finney created without notice during the summer. I hated it. I never got inured to the jumping. At every meeting, the limb seemed higher, thinner, the deeper water harder to reach. Every time when I got myself into position to jump, I felt a flash of disbelief that I was doing anything so perilous. But I always jumped. Otherwise, I would have lost face with Phineas, and that would have been unthinkable. We met every night, because Finney's life was ruled by inspiration and anarchy, and so he prized a set of rules. His own, not those imposed on him by other people, such as the faculty of the Devon School. The Super Suicide Society of the summer session was a club. Clubs, by definition, meet regularly. We met every night. Nothing could be more regular than that. To meet once a week seemed to him much less regular, entirely too haphazard, bordering on carelessness. I went along. I never missed a meeting. At that time, it would never have occurred to me to say, "I don't feel like it tonight," which was the plain truth every night. I was subject to the dictates of my mind, which gave me the maneuverability of a straitjacket. "We're off, pal," Finney would call out, and acting against every instinct of my nature, I went without a thought of protest. As we drifted on through the summer, with this one inflexible appointment every day, classes could be cut, meals missed, chapels skipped, I noticed something about Finney's own mind which was such an opposite from mine. It wasn't completely unleashed after all. I noticed that he did abide by certain rules, which he seemed to cast in the form of commandments. "Never say you are 5'9" when you are 5'8½, was the first one I encountered. Another was, "Always say some prayers at night, because it might turn out that there is a God." But the one which had the most urgent influence in his life was, "You always win at sports." This "you" was collective. Everyone always won at sports. When you played a game, you won, in the same way as when you sat down to a meal, you ate it. It inevitably and naturally followed. Finney never permitted himself to realize that when you won, they lost. That would have destroyed the perfect beauty which was sport. Nothing bad ever happened in sports. They were the absolute good. He was disgusted with that summer's athletic program. A little tennis, some swimming, clumsy softball games, badminton.
badminton? He exploded the day it entered the schedule. He said nothing else, but the shocked, outraged, despairing note of anguish in the word said all the rest.
Badminton?
At least it's not as bad as the seniors, I said, handing him the fragile racket and the fey shuttlecock. They're doing calisthenics.
What are they trying to do?
He swatted the shuttlecock the length of the locker room.
Destroy us?
Humor infiltrated the outrage in his voice, which meant that he was thinking of a way out. We went outside into the cordial afternoon sunshine. The playing fields were optimistically green and empty before us. The tennis courts were full. The softball diamond was busy. A pattern of badminton nets swayed sensually in the breeze. Finney eyed them with quiet astonishment. Far down the fields, toward the river, there was a wooden tower about 10 feet high where the instructor had stood to direct the senior calisthenics. It was empty now. The seniors had been trotted off to the improvised obstacle course in the woods, or to have their blood pressure taken again, or to undergo an insidious exercise in the cage, which consisted in stepping up on a box and down again in rapid rhythm for 5 minutes. They were off somewhere, shaping up for the war. All the fields were ours. Finney began to walk slowly in the direction of the tower. Perhaps he was thinking that we might carry it the rest of the way to the river and throw it in. Perhaps he was just interested in looking at it, as he was in everything. Whatever he thought, he forgot it when we reached the tower. Beside it, someone had left a large and heavy leather-covered ball, a medicine ball. He picked it up.
Now this, you see, is everything in the world you need for sports. When they discovered the circle, they created sports. As for this thing,
embracing the medicine ball in his left arm, he held up the shuttlecock, contaminated, in his outstretched right.
This idiot tickler. The only thing it's good for is eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
He dropped the ball and proceeded to pick the feathers out of the shuttlecock, distastefully, as though removing ticks from a dog. The remaining rubber plug he then threw out of sight down the field with a single lunge ending in a powerful downward thrust of his wrist. Badminton was gone. He stood balancing the medicine ball, enjoying the feel of it.
All you really need is a round ball.
Although he was rarely conscious of it, Phineas was always being watched, like the weather. Up the field, the others at badminton sensed a shift in the wind. Their voices carried down to us, calling us. When we didn't come, they began gradually to come down to us.
"I think it's about time we started to get a little exercise around here, don't you?"
he said, cocking his head at me. Then he slowly looked around at the others with the expression of dazed determination he used when the object was to carry people along with his latest idea. He blinked twice and then said,
"We can always start with this ball."
"Let's make it have something to do with the war," suggested Bobby Zane, "like a blitzkrieg or something."
"Blitzkrieg," repeated Finney doubtfully.
"We could figure out some kind of blitzkrieg baseball," I said.
"We'll call it Blitzkrieg Ball," said Bobby.
"Or just Blitzball," reflected Finney. "Yes, Blitzball."
Then, with an expectant glance around,
"Well, let's get started."
He threw the big, heavy ball at me. I grasped it against my chest with both arms.
"Well, run," ordered Finney.
"No, not that way, toward the river, run."
I headed toward the river, surrounded by the others in a hesitant herd. They sensed that in all probability they were my adversaries in blitzball.
"Don't hog it," Finney yelled. "Throw it to someone else. Otherwise, naturally,"
he talked steadily as he ran along beside me,
"now that we've got you surrounded, one of us will knock you down."
"Do what?" I veered away from him, hanging on to the clumsy ball.
"What kind of game is that?"
"Blitzball!"
Chet Douglas shouted, throwing himself around my legs, knocking me down.
"That, naturally, was completely illegal," said Finney.
You don't use your arms when you knock the ball carrier down.
You don't?
Mumbled Chet from on top of me.
No. You keep your arms crossed like this on your chest, and you just butt the ball carrier. No elbowing allowed, either.
All right, Gene. Start again.
I began quickly.
Wouldn't someone else have possession of the ball after?
Not when you've been knocked down illegally. The ball carrier retains possession in a case like that. So it's perfectly okay. You still have the ball. Go ahead.
There was nothing to do but to start running again, with the others trampling with stronger will around me.
Throw it,
ordered Phineas. Bobby Zane was more or less in the clear, so I threw it at him. It was so heavy that he had to scoop up my throw from the ground.
Perfectly okay,
commented Finney, running forward at top speed.
Perfectly okay for the ball to touch the ground when it's being passed.
Bobby doubled back closer to me for protection.
Knock him down,
Finney yelled at me. Knock him down? Are you crazy? He's on my team.
There aren't any teams in blitzball,
he yelled somewhat irritably.
We're all enemies. Knock him down.
I knocked him down.
All right,
Finney said as he disentangled us.
Now you have possession again.
He handed the leaden ball to me. I would have thought that possession passed.
Naturally, you gain possession of the ball when you knocked him down.
Run!
So I began running again. Leper Lepellier was loping along outside my perimeter, not noticing the game, tagging along without reason, like a porpoise escorting a passing ship.
Leper!
I threw the ball past a few heads at him. Taken by surprise, Leper looked up in anguish, shrank away from the ball, and voiced his first thought, a typical one.
I don't want it! Stop! Stop!
Cried Finney in his referee's tone. Everyone halted, and Finney retrieved the ball. He talked better holding it.
Now Leper has just brought out a really important fine point of the game. The receiver can refuse a pass if he happens to choose to. Since we're all enemies, we can and will turn on each other all the time. We'll call that the Lepellier refusal.
We all nodded without speaking.
Here, Gene, the ball is, of course, still yours.
Still mine? Nobody else has had the ball but me, for God's sakes.
They'll get their chance. Now, if you are refused 3 times in the course of running from the tower to the river, you go all the way back to the tower and start over. Naturally.
Blitzball was the surprise of the summer. Everybody played it. I believe a form of it is still popular at Devon, but nobody can be playing it as it was played by Phineas. He had unconsciously invented a game which brought his own athletic gifts to their highest pitch. The odds were tremendously against the ball carrier, so that Phineas was driven to exceed himself practically every day when he carried the ball. To escape the wolf pack, which all the other players became, he created reverses and deceptions and acts of sheer mass hypnotism, which were so extraordinary that they surprised even him. After some of these plays, I would notice him chuckling quietly to himself, in a kind of happy disbelief. In such a non-stop game, he also had the natural advantage of a flow of energy which I never saw interrupted. I never saw him tired, never really winded, never overcharged, and never restless. At dawn, all day long, and at midnight, Phineas always had a steady and formidable flow of usable energy. Right from the start, it was clear that no one had ever been better adapted to a sport than Finney was to blitzball. I saw that right away.
Why not? He had made it up, hadn't he?
It needn't be surprising that he was sensationally good at it, and that the rest of us were more or less bumblers in our different ways. I suppose it served us right for letting him do all the planning. I really didn't think about it myself. What difference did it make? It was just a game. It was good that Finney could shine at it. He could also shine at many other things. With people, for instance. The others in our dormitory. The faculty. In fact, if you stop to think about it, Finney could shine with everyone. He attracted everyone he met. I was glad of that, too. Naturally. He was my roommate and my best friend. Everyone has a moment in history which belongs particularly to him. It is the moment when his emotions achieve their most powerful sway over him. And afterward, when you say to this person, the world today, or life, or reality, he will assume that you mean this moment, even if it's 50 years past. The world, through his unleashed emotions, imprinted itself upon him, and he carries the stamp of that passing moment forever. For me, this moment, 4 years is a moment in history, was the war. The war was and is reality for me. I still instinctively live and think in its atmosphere. These are some of its characteristics. Franklin Delano Roosevelt is the President of the United States, and he always has been. The other two eternal world leaders are Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. America is not, never has been, and never will be what the songs and poems call it, a land of plenty. Nylon, meat, gasoline, and steel are rare. There are too many jobs and not enough workers. Money is very easy to earn, but rather hard to spend because there isn't very much to buy. Trains are always late and always crowded with servicemen. The war will always be fought very far from America, and it will never end. Nothing in America stands still for very long, including the people, who are always either leaving or on leave. People in America cry often. 16 is the key and crucial and natural age for a human being to be, and people of all other ages are arranged in an orderly manner ahead of and behind you as a harmonious setting for the 16-year-olds of this world. When you are 16, adults are slightly impressed and almost intimidated by you. This is a puzzle, finally solved by the realization that they foresee your military future, fighting for them. You do not foresee it. To waste anything in America is immoral. String and tinfoil are treasures. Newspapers are always crowded with strange maps and names of towns, and every few months the earth seems to lurch from its path when you see something in the newspapers, such as the time Mussolini, who had almost seemed one of the eternal leaders, is photographed hanging upside down on a meat hook. Everyone listens to news broadcasts 5 or 6 times every day. All pleasurable things, all travel and sports and entertainment and good food and fine clothes, are in the very shortest supply. Always were and always will be. There are just tiny fragments of pleasure and luxury in the world, and there is something unpatriotic about enjoying them. All foreign lands are inaccessible except to servicemen. They are vague, distant, and sealed off as though behind a curtain of plastic. The prevailing color of life in America is a dull, dark green called olive drab. That color is always respectable and always important. Most other colors risk being unpatriotic. It is this special America, a very untypical one, I guess, an unfamiliar transitional blur in the memories of most people, which is the real America for me. In that short-lived and special country, we spent this summer at Devon when Finney achieved certain feats as an athlete. In such a period, no one notices or rewards any achievement involving the body unless the result is to kill it or save it on the battlefield, so that there were only a few of us to applaud and wonder at what he was able to do. One day, he broke the school swimming record. He and I were fooling around in the pool near a big bronze plaque marked with events for which the school kept records. 50 yards, 100 yards, 220 yards. Under each was a slot with a marker fitted into it, showing the name of the record holder, his year, and his time. Under 100 yards freestyle, there was A. Hopkins Parker, 1940, 53.0 seconds. A. Hopkins Parker. Finney squinted up at the name. I don't remember any A. Hopkins Parker. He graduated before we got here. You mean that record has been up there the whole time we've been at Devon, and nobody's busted it yet? It was an insult to the class, and Finney had tremendous loyalty to the class, as he did to any group he belonged to, beginning with him and me, and radiating outward past the limits of humanity, toward spirits and clouds and stars. No one else happened to be in the pool. Around us gleamed white tile and glass brick,
the green, artificial-looking water rocked gently in its shining basin, releasing vague chemical smells and a sense of many pipes and filters. Even Finney's voice, trapped in this closed, high-ceilinged room, lost its special resonance and blurred into a general well of noise gathered up toward the ceiling. He said blurringly,
"I have a feeling I could swim faster than A. Hopkins Parker."
We found a stopwatch in the office. He mounted a starting box, leaned forward from the waist, as he had seen racing swimmers do, but never had the occasion to do himself. I noticed a preparatory looseness coming into his shoulders and arms, a controlled ease about his stance, which was unexpected in anyone trying to break a record. I said, "On your mark, go!" There was a complex moment when his body uncoiled and shot forward with sudden metallic tension. He planed up the pool, his shoulders dominating the water, while his legs and feet rode so low that I couldn't distinguish them. A wake rippled hurriedly by him, and then, at the end of the pool, his position broke. He relaxed, dived in, an instant's confusion, and then his suddenly and metallically tense body shot back toward the other end of the pool. Another turn, and up the pool again. I noticed no particular slackening in his pace. Another turn, down the pool again, his hand touched the end. He looked up at me with a composed, interested expression. "Well, how did I do?" I looked at the watch. He had broken A. Hopkins Parker's record by 0.7 second. "My God, so I really did it. You know what? I thought I was going to do it. It felt as though I had that stopwatch in my head, and I could hear myself going just a little bit faster than A. Hopkins Parker. The worst thing is there weren't any witnesses, and I'm no official timekeeper. I don't think it will count." "Well, of course it won't count. You can try it again and break it again. Tomorrow. We'll get the coach in here and all the official timekeepers, and I'll call up the Devonian to send a reporter and a photographer." He climbed out of the pool. "I'm not going to do it again," he said quietly. "Of course you are." "No, I just wanted to see if I could do it. Now I know. But I don't want to do it in public." Some other swimmers drifted in through the door. Finney glanced sharply at them.
"By the way," he said in an even more subdued voice, "we aren't going to talk about this. It's just between you and me. Don't say anything about it to anyone."
"Not say anything about it? When you broke the school record? Shh!"
He shot a blazing, agitated glance at me. I stopped, and I looked at him up and down. He didn't look directly back at me. "You're too good to be true," I said after a while. He glanced at me and then said,
"Thanks a lot,"
in a somewhat expressionless voice. Was he trying to impress me or something? Not tell anybody? When he had broken a school record without a day of practice? I knew he was serious about it, so I didn't tell anybody. Perhaps for that reason, his accomplishment took root in my mind and grew rapidly in the darkness where I was forced to hide it. The Devon School record books contained a mistake, a lie, and nobody knew it but Finney and me. A. Hopkins Parker was living in a fool's paradise, wherever he was. His defeated name remained in bronze on the school record plaque, while Finney deliberately evaded an athletic honor. It was true that he had many already. The Winslow Galbraith Memorial Football Trophy, for having brought the most Christian sportsmanship to the game during the 1941-1942 season. The Margaret Duke Bonaventura Ribbon and Prize for the student who conducted himself at hockey most like the way her son had done. The Devon School Contact Sport Award, presented each year to that student who, in the opinion of the athletic advisors, excels his fellows in the sportsmanlike performance of any game involving bodily contact. But these were in the past, and they were prizes, not school records. The sports Finney played officially, football, hockey, baseball, lacrosse, didn't have school records. To switch to a new sport suddenly, just for a day, and immediately break a record in it? That was about as neat a trick, as dazzling a reversal as I could, to be perfectly honest, possibly imagine.
There was something inebriating in the suppleness of this feat. When I thought about it, my head felt a little dizzy, and my stomach began to tingle. It had, in one word, glamour. Absolute schoolboy glamour. When I looked down at that stopwatch and realized a split second before I permitted my face to show it or my voice to announce it that Finney had broken a school record, I had experienced a feeling that can also be described in one word. Shock. To keep silent about this amazing happening deepened that shock for me. It made Finney seem too unusual for, not for friendship, but too unusual for rivalry. And there were few relationships among us at Devon not based on rivalry. "Swimming in pools is screwy anyway," he said after a long, unusual silence as we walked toward the dormitory. "The only real swimming is in the ocean." Then, in the everyday, mediocre tone he used when he was proposing something really outrageous, he added, "Let's go to the beach." The beach was hours away by bicycle. Forbidden, completely out of bounds. Going there risked expulsion, destroyed the studying I was going to do for an important test the next morning, blasted the reasonable amount of order I wanted to maintain in my life, and it also involved the kind of long, labored bike ride I hated. "All right," I said. We got on our bikes and slipped away from Devon along a back road. Having invited me, Finney now felt he had to keep me entertained. He told long, wild stories about his childhood. And as I pumped, panting up steep hills, he glided along beside me, joking steadily. He analyzed my character, and he insisted on knowing what I disliked most about him. "You're too conventional," I said. He rode backward with no hands. He rode on his handlebars. He jumped off and back on his moving bike, as he had seen trick horseback riders do in the movies. He sang. Despite the steady musical undertone in his speaking voice, Finney couldn't carry a tune, and he couldn't remember the melody or the words to any song. But he loved listening to music, any music, and he liked to sing. We reached the beach late in the afternoon. The tide was high and the surf heavy. I dived in, rode a couple of waves, but they had reached that stage of power in which you could feel the whole strength of the ocean in them. The second wave, as it tore toward the beach with me, spewed me a little ahead of it. Encroaching rapidly, suddenly it was immeasurably bigger than I was. It rushed me from the control of gravity and took control of me itself. The wave threw me down in a primitive plunge without a bottom. Then there was a bottom, grinding sand, and I skidded onto shore. The wave hesitated, balanced there, and then hissed back toward the deep water, its tentacles not quite interested enough in me to drag me with it. I made my way up on the beach and laid down. Finney came, ceremoniously took my pulse, and then went back into the ocean. He stayed in an hour, breaking off every few minutes to come back to me and talk. The sand was so hot from the all-day sunshine that I had to brush the top layer away in order to lie down on it. And Finney's progress across the beach became a series of high, startled leaps. The ocean, throwing up foaming sun sprays across some nearby rocks, was winter cold. This kind of sunshine and ocean, with the accumulating roar of the surf and the salty, adventurous, flirting wind from the sea, always intoxicated Phineas. He was everywhere. He enjoyed himself hugely. He laughed out loud at passing seagulls. And he did everything he could think of for me.